My name is Chip Starsky. I also go by the name of Steve Murray. I'm not going to explain that to you. And this panel is about newspapers, comic books, comic strips, and the internet. You know, a very, very narrow topic, so we should be done in like 5 minutes. It's about the future, as everything is from day to day. And what the future holds for the traditional comic strip in the newspaper, for the non-traditional online comic strips, newspapers in general, print in general, comic book print, comic books online. It's everything. It's everything. So I'd like to introduce the panel. Starting to my left, Richard Stevens III.
Is this Canadian water?
Other than the best. Richard Stevens III, he's the creator of the comic Beetle Sweeties. He had a deal going with United Future Syndicate, and he left that deal willingly, which is shocking.
Not willingly, so much as runningly.
Runningly. So now he's concentrating solely on the web and merchandising, and you are the internet to me. So, yeah, there's that. Next to Richard, Brandon Gerford, comics editor for King's Feature, cartoonist, publisher, all around great guy. I just met him, but
bumpy
hi to me.
He's a bumpy
I
one.
Like that.
That's
I like that as a man. Also, Syncopated?
Syncopated.
I think you need to talk a bit about the syncopated because I feel that's the future of comics.
It's a dismal future. I'm
post-apocalyptic.
Next to Brendan is John Mars. John Mars, co-creator of Drawn.ca, very popular. It's on the internet. He's the chair of the Canadian chapter of the National Cartoonist Society. National being, Canada.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if that makes it better or worse. And he's handsome. He's got a great beard. Unbelievable artist. Good guy. Next to him, Stuart Eminem. Stuart.
Weaker beard.
The
best
of
the lesser.
Chiseled. Amazing hair.
I'm seeing it up close. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
When Chris Butcher wrote the bio, he wrote, "Your college mainstream." He put it in quotes. I don't know why that was a quote, but I'm adding that right now. On a variety of projects, you've done pretty much everything, haven't you?
Yeah.
Pretty much everything. Okay.
Slowly taking over.
Slowly but surely, this industry. He's also a self-publisher. Beautiful books. Serializes work online, collects, puts out moving pictures, ladies auxiliary. Lovely. Never as bad as you think, which is a beautiful little book and very inspiring to myself. Next to Stuart, Scott McCloud, wrote a couple books. That's pretty much all I know about Scott. What was it? Thinking comics? Wondering about comics? I don't know.
Reading comics. No.
Clearly, he's the most important man in the room. Just saying.
It's all downhill from here.
Yeah. And that's the panel.
Those doors are not real, Joe. Those are incinerators.
Hey, same difference. It's fine. I want to start with Rich.
Okay.
He's closest to me. That's why there's no importance in there. Your situation terrifies me.
You mean like they wear long sleeves with shorts? Or?
The idea of, I was raised on the dream of the idea of getting a syndicated comic with my tracings of Garfield, but never kind of got off the ground. And so you achieve this dream, and then you spit on the dream, spit in the dream space.
It was
prop spit. It wasn't spit.
Okay.
It was blood, actually.
So what was the process for it? And I'm thinking more kind of your emotional state, like when you...
You mean like how vulnerable I was?
Yeah, a little bit of that, because like I said, it is the dream for a lot of cartoonists to kind of get everywhere and print like that. And when I say everywhere, I don't
know. Well, okay.
Okay.
The analogy I like to make, I was already surviving for about 5 or 6 years off my website, doing my own thing, and I had really no... I always liked syndicated comics as a kid, but I never was under any illusion that they would want me. So when the developing editor for UFS offered, I figured, give it a shot. If it wasn't me, it was going to go to somebody else. So, I mean, why not try it? And... the most important thing I learned about that is that webcomics are like showing up at your job every day and shooting to be middle class. And syndication was more like you're broke, but you buy a lottery ticket. And if you succeed in it, you could still just be monstrous. But there were a lot less opportunities to really earn a reasonable living as a new cartoonist. And I just couldn't do the two at once anymore. I did my web strip at the same time as my print strip so that I wouldn't be giving up my day job, basically. And after a couple of years, I just felt like I should go back to what was my day job, doing what worked best for me, and working alone and doing merchandise like what Chip is wearing. So, it fit my personality better. And it didn't, the state of newspapers, they're not going anywhere, but it's hard to get in. Paper by paper basis for millions of reasons, which we could do a whole panel on.
Yeah.
I mean, it was sad to go, but it was worth a try. Yeah. It was fun.
Learned a lot. Do you feel, and this is applicable to everyone, I'm finding now more and more people just trying to do, we're all trying to do too much. Like because there are the separate avenues now. Like you've got online, and then you've got print. Like I find, you know, I'm doing stuff for newspapers, and so I'm going through that entire process. And while I'm doing that, I'm like, okay, now I got to think about how I'm going to promote this online. How am I going to adapt this online? You know, and then I think about like things like merchandise and physical comics at home and stuff like that. So in your situation, you've got these two things happening simultaneously. There's only so many hours in the day. I know you. I know your love of the Red Bull. Ride the bull. Ride the bull.
Sometimes the bull rides me.
Sometimes the bull rides as well. Do you think that's a factor as well? Like if you focus exclusively on one or the other, is that death or?
Does anybody here focus exclusively on one or the other? I mean, even Stuart.
No, that's the thing.
I mean, he's. No, I mean you've got
Stuart.
You've got the dream too. You know, working on the mainstream stuff, but you still do your own stuff, and that's I think the real dream, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we started out self-publishing 20 odd years ago, and it seemed like a feasible way to get out of working in a record store, which is what I had been doing.
That's a really reasonable goal to have, and you can do that with the internet or self-publishing.
Yeah, I mean the internet. Basically returns us in a lot of ways to that level of engagement that we had doing independent black and white comics and getting good distribution physically to stores. I mean, we can do away with the physical distribution altogether, obviously, and reach a potentially much greater audience and still have total control over the work. The problem with me is that now my day job is no longer in the record store, it's working in comics, and I've got to find room in my week to do more comics instead of choosing that as my, you know, my one love. I've got to split the love.
Split the love.
Split the love.
Split the love. Back to the syndication thing, because with my friend in here now, you're in a key position as an editor this weekend. Listening to Rich and the situation, how, you know, went in, didn't work, pull out.
But keep in mind, though, that a lot of it is personality-based. Like, a lot of us, that just to preface that, because he can probably answer better, a lot of people don't want to do all their merchandise. A lot of people don't want to promote things, and they want to work for a company that'll take care of a lot of things for you. And some people are just weird and want to do all that stuff.
I think that's true, and I also think that... In your particular case, and a lot of cartoonists that are launching in recent years, they're at an incredible disadvantage because newspapers are in rough shape. they don't have a whole lot of money to throw around. They're not expanding their comic section. They're shrinking them in some cases or just standing pat with what they have. If you want to get a new comic strip into a newspaper, an old comic strip is coming out to make room for it.
Pulling the letters.
And editors do not want to hear, what the hell did you do to Broomhilda? What is this crazy Diesel Sweeties that took over
people,
before?
Yeah,
it's true, and they'll hate you for it.
I took and, Kathy away.
Yeah, and then
once.
She could be in the audience. We don't know.
Met her. It's been this way for a long time.
Yeah.
I think that it's always been difficult for a new strip to get legs, and it's probably just a little bit more difficult today than it has always been. I don't think it was your strip's fault. I also don't think it was your personality. I think it was that the market was not ready for a strip that was probably a little more edgy than the newspaper readers and their common denominator that joins them.
But the personality thing is why I lost patience, personally. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do my own thing. And then it actually goes back to your day job. Mm-hmm. So if I had a regular day job, I would have kept doing it for the opportunity to do a comic strip. Yeah. But I already had a comic strip.
Where the personalities come in, I think some people just want it so bad they're willing to sacrifice and suffer. You know, I mean, a big part of my job is playing, it's the couch. You know, I'm sitting there with the notepad and everything and saying, talking them off a ledge and saying, don't worry, it's worth it. Write it out. Let's see where it goes. If we're still having this conversation in two or three years, maybe it's time to think about a different plan or something else to do with yourself. But, it's interesting. I mean, it still is kind of this Cinderella profession. There's just a fewer, Cinderellas being crowned. That's all. And we have success stories in the last several years. I mean, some enormous success stories of people who have launched a new comic strip in this recent millennium and become extremely successful. I mean, I think of United, I think of, Heston. Stefan Bastis, I tried to join
him. Girls with Force Wine.
Girls with Force
Wine.
Get Fuzzy. Yeah. My wife does a comic strip called Tina's Group, which is in the Toronto Star here, and she's in over 100 papers, and she does very well with that. We've had a couple of successes at King Features, and I know Universal's had some successes with things like Argyle Sweater and a couple other panels, but it can happen. It's just it's really, really difficult, and insult to injury is newspapers are in extremely rough shape right now.
How is the kind of business model, or what are the syndicates actually doing to kind of adapt, or what's kind of coming, like a train just bearing down on you, and that light just hitting you in the face, and it's going to explode you into a million pieces. That's how I feel every day.
I don't think it's that imminent. I think that it's a little bit more of a slow-moving steamroller as opposed to a breaker. We're all going to be flattened, but it's going to take a long time.
Yeah. You're tied to the tracks. I'm sorry.
But the legs can come off.
Live without the legs. That's my motto.
It's interesting. So if you look at the different syndicates, I think that, with King Features, we're taking, obviously very obvious strategies toward new media with the web and mobile devices and licensing entertainment and all the different permutations that comic strips can benefit from. But not all the syndicates act the same. They all have their own strategies. I think that at the end of the day, these companies are very big and very healthy. As bad as business is, King Features is extremely well off.
Newspapers going away isn't going to kill your licensing revenue.
We still license Betty Boop and Popeye. I mean, that's mm-hmm. I mean that can
that's
carry
enough
us
to keep you paid.
That can keep us carry us into the 25th century. I mean, it's insane. But
when newspapers do disappear, then it is just Betty Boop and like new characters that are previously known. Like, how do you what kind of business model can you have? Like, obviously, you said it came, I pick up the paper, this is my paper, and this is my region, so this is my Garfield.
Right.
This is the paper that has it. And, but obviously, once you put it online, I search for Garfield, and
right.
I find Garfield, and that's that. I don't care who hosts it, man.
And the survival of local markets is going to be critical, because people have to feel as though that newspaper or online edition of a newspaper, some sort of information source where they get their stay in touch with the world. It has to be local, so they feel that it's not just this Big Brother kind of experience. But I think that I'm a cautious optimist when it comes to all of this. You know, I believe people want this, and I believe that there's an insane number of talented cartoonists, and there are talented people also at these companies, at the comic book publishers, at the syndicates, that are smart enough to navigate what is a very confusing Wild West sort of environment right now, and eventually find some way to bring the comics to people that that want them. It's just a little different. I think that, you know, there's we used to be able to take for granted an enthusiast market because we had to sell to this lower common denominator of newspaper readers. That might have to change. Maybe we have to focus a little more heavy and embrace someone like Rich's comics and let it stand on its own.
More comics, but less really enthusiastic reads, like smaller audience, but more into it. Kind
exactly,
of
exactly. I think that, you know, Blondie may not be able to survive this change, but Diesel speaks very well.
Don't say that.
Diesel Blondie. Diesel Blondie.
I'll write Blondie in a minute.
Yeah. Why not? Blondie in a minute. I've said enough. Go on.
I just had a thought as you were talking. You know, one of the interesting things is, of course, one of the great challenges for newspaper strips is the whole common denominator thing, and it's like, oh my God, I'm going to offend somebody. That's really hard. And part of that is the universal appeal aspect of it, and that feeds into things like merchandising and everything. But just now, it's like smaller audiences. Like one thing that suddenly I'm picturing is like, okay, newspapers have regions, they have territory, and you have a big city, you have a big city newspaper, and even though they're getting content from BAP and elsewhere, are still the local thing. And suddenly I had this thought, you know, like there are a lot of cities that have a lot of really great cartoonists. What if suddenly half the comics showing up in these cities, the arts papers and even in the traditional papers, suddenly has just comics about their city?
By local.
Can you imagine, like, if half of the comics in the, does the Toronto Star even have comics? What if half of them took place in Toronto? And all of a sudden, I got one paper, you know, instead of like I got 100 papers. But that one paper, you know, I have 100,000, 200,000.
Well, then you're the staff cartoonist. And I think that's a very desirable position.
And then you're famous in town.
You're famous in town.
But for a newspaper, that's far more expensive to have a staff artist than to buy a pre-made cartoon from a syndicate.
What if it's a really great comic that has a very strong local component, say, Scott Pilgrim, for example, right? So that it actually has range beyond the territory, but it's coming out regularly in this local venue, but then it has this ancillary outlet of like book collections.
You know what you're doing too there is you're almost creating the famous weatherman. You know, like how the news will have a lovable weatherman, but now you're making these local cartoonists that you could use as a local celebrity or to do newspaper stuff with too. You're making a little personality you can send to things too.
But you can only have so many. And the other thing is that even a paper that called the Toronto Star is not just regional, but it's just distributed nationwide.
It is.
So, you know, while that may fly, the Toronto-centric strip may fly here, and maybe even larger provincially, although there are a lot of communities that hate Toronto, frankly, that are right here in Ontario.
But think about it, if you live in Minneapolis, right, you're subscribing to the New Yorker, you're not going to be all like, oh, here's Art Spiegelman, or he's Sendak walking through Central Park. I'm sick of this Central Park thing. Yeah. I get the New Yorker so I don't have to read stories about New York. I'm like, well, of course.
But I think you could, of the spectrum of strips that are available in the Star, you could only have one or maybe two or three that were so locally oriented to be successful.
I'm also not sure it's entirely necessary. Chip hit on something really interesting. He goes, it's my Garfield when it's in the Toronto Star. And people probably think that Jim Davis like lives in Toronto and creates this strictly
for. I
remember when I was
reading of Garfield with hats.
Hello, Toronto. Change that word.
Keep a space just big enough that, you know, when Albuquerque comes up, you're screwed, though, because it's really long.
I'm retracting.
Right.
But it's a funny word. So
Albuquerque.
Payoff is that a funnier word.
I need to ALBQ period.
Albuquerque.
And people will know. Yeah.
I do a comic strip that is so local, because I work for the National Post, and they want me to do a comic, and I'm like, I don't have any time for this. So I just went through the comic, and I took the headshots of all the columnists, And I used them as clip art. I just started putting words in their mouth called the posties, and they would go on adventures and things like that. It does work, but you can only have one of those in the paper for sure.
But ultimately, the point here is that it's a good idea, Scott. But it's first of all, I think it's unnecessary because people, if they see it in a local entity, they're going to believe it has a localism to it, even if it's not making specific reference to a street that they know or something. But also, one of the sad reasons it can't work is that we have to be able to do a million different things as cartoonists, as publishers, and put them in a million different places in order to find that critical mass of success.
Yeah.
So I think it's wonderful, and there's some great examples. I mean, editorial cartooning is probably the one that's taken the dagger to the heart most notably in the last year or two.
Yeah.
I mean, to every other vital organ. But there is that sort of local celebrity there, you know. I work with Jim Boardman on the Zitz comic strip, and he walks down the street in Cincinnati, and they all get down and genuflect. I mean, it's insane. Because he's the staff cartoonist at the Cincinnati Inquirer, or was. He retired, but anyway, interesting. Onward.
I was going to say, editorial cartoonist, I want to talk to John about your role as chair of the National Cartoonist Society. It's kind of like editorial cartoonist Armageddon out there. The apocalypse has rained down upon us. And you've been in the position for like 2 years or so?
Yeah, just over 2 years. Well, for those that don't know, the National Cartoonist Society is an organization based out of the States, and so that's the national. And the Canadian chapter really just represents the Canadian members that are a part of the NCS. There we go.
It's on.
That's all right. And the Canadian chapter does not actually have any editorial cartoonists in it because they have their own organization.
So you kicked them out.
Yeah. And we don't like to intermingle. So I can't really speak for...
That editorial cartoonist section must just be really sad then. If that's their own thing, like, oh my God, like... Just death out there.
Oh, you want to hear a sad story about it? The AAEC, which is the American Association of Editorial Cartoonists, has the convention every year. Yes. And they scream it with that sort of as well. They were to have their convention this year in Seattle. And, you know, it's an annual gathering of just editorial cartoonists. There's panels probably not unlike this one where people discuss things, etc. But, the big sponsor for the show was the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which sold out all of their support and turned into a blog overnight. And, I mean, this is the sort of harsh reality that a group like that is dealing with.
So sad.
It's a sad story. I told you a sad story.
I gotta get out of newspapers.
Come to webcomics. The water's tepid.
Yeah. Yeah. When's this conversation going to go there?
It's so much work.
Is the syndicate or are our syndicates trolling the web looking for new material?
Yeah, exactly.
He needed somebody in 6 weeks who could be ready. And
they were trolling the web, are they still?
Yeah, they are. Absolutely. I know some people that were getting approached before the guy that hired me lost his job due to cutback.
I can tell you as the troller.
It's a good place to look. You got people with years worth of material, and you can decide.
Yeah. It's true. Yeah.
Well, in print comics, it's a similar situation. I mean, across the board in the industry, from the largest publishers right on down, they're looking for people who have had the initiative to self-produce. They want people who are doing stuff on their own with, you know, little or no expectation of compensation, just because they want to do it. They want to see that people are enthusiastic and willing to put in the effort, rather than hiring, you know, 18, 19-year-olds, as happened in the 80s and 90s, who had no business experience, you know, no idea of how to promote themselves or maintain a business model of any kind, and, you know, maybe had a big splash doing a miniseries or 5 or 6 issues, but then had no way to, no resources to draw on to be able to sustain that.
Yeah.
So they want to see people that are doing things on their own, improving themselves before they'll give them a chance.
But is there an element of making sure that somebody isn't going to be a really good artist who runs out of ideas in a month?
That's huge.
You're going to have somebody pretty good who can go for years.
Signing a long-term contract in syndication, at least. Yeah, in comic books, it's probably a little different, a little more project-based, I imagine. But
in some cases, but there are certainly contracts involved that are multi-year.
But you could get an exclusive working at a publisher for a number of years or something like that.
Mm-hmm. These companies are as risk-averse as anybody else on the planet is. They want to know that it's not just will they do it or have the will to do it, or they capable of doing it.
Sure.
You know, can they sustain a high level of quality over a period of time, and are they not making a poor investment by working with this person? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a great scouting tool to find out that someone is, you know, the DIY type.
Sure, you can gauge personalities to an extent too. I mean, making sure if it's somebody who's wildly inconsistent, why would you even bother? You know?
Yeah, and their voice is going to be heard too on there. If they're keeping a blog or have any kind of, you know, forum personality, they're going to have put themselves out there, and you're going to know, do I want to work with this guy, or is he going to be an asshole?
Hey, no. This isn't the PPP panel.
I didn't say that.
I didn't say that.
Who said that? I didn't say that.
I didn't hear it, so it's fine. So switching over to formats then, obviously, print's not dead, as I can't actually walk through the aisles down here as people sell their print products. For those of you that have had a career in print, especially Stuart and Scott, are you finding your focus changing in terms of what is going to see print? Like, is there something that's just so kind of print-worthy, I guess, that becomes your focus for, like, say, shows like this? Versus the online stuff?
I tend to do pretty long-term projects. So, for instance, I have a graphic novel that's going to take me 3 years.
Yeah.
And I always kind of saw it as a graphic novel. Also, I had lots of very passionate ideas about, like, oh, the web should do this, web can do this, I'm going to try to do this. And I kept like bashing into the wall. And then I was at a point where I was like, yeah, I'm going to take three years off and see how it sorts itself out. I'm sidelined a little. But I did see it as a print project, so it kind of fits that now I'm doing it as a print project.
Yeah.
But I see the differences more clearly than ever, aesthetically.
Yeah. Does it become harder to devote time to, like 3 years or so? That's a long time to go without getting the eyes of the world coming back. Like, that's the one thing I find online. Like, even working on something for the newspaper, like, you know, that's just like a day turnaround, and I'm still just like, come on.
Yeah, no, you're right. In fact, if you look closely at what I did, like, the last several months, what I do, I get this deal to do this book that I wanted to do. I'm going to be a hermit. I'm going to draw. I'm just going to do nothing but make this book. And what's the first thing I do is find it. As soon as I know I'm heading down that rabbit hole, time to redesign the site. Time to get the blog up and running again. Make sure that I don't become invisible for 3 years.
Yeah.
And so I saw a lot of guys were doing that just in the last few months. As everything was kind of like falling into this giant hole, you saw a lot of people like climbing back up and saying, I'm here, hey, look, redesign. Like, guys were learning CSS left and right, you know, with like old clunky sites like I had, because they realized, I have to have a presence, even if I'm not doing a regular webcomic, I have to have a presence, a face, a voice, I have to be part of the conversation, because, you know, like for somebody like me, I'm going to be missing in action for a while.
That terrifies me. Like, if I go like 1 week without being online, like I've hurt my arm, and then now like typing's kind of painful, and I'm like, I've got to be online. If I'm not online, who am I?
They used to say that about San Diego, the San Diego Comic Convention. They say, if you miss 3 San Diegos, everybody, including your friends, will think you're dead.
So, Stuart, with moving pictures, is that the kind of reasoning behind putting it online in installments then? Just to kind of remind people, or...?
Well, no, not so much. And in fact, moving pictures was always... intended for print and designed for print, but what the web does for us is that it creates this impetus to keep it going, because this is, as I said, not my day job. It's not how I make a living, but it's still material that I want to do. I've got to find the time to do it. So what the internet has provided is demand, and that might be just a handful of people that come to the site. We can't do it daily, So I can manage to do a page once a week, and we update every Friday. But any more than that really encroaches on my stuff for Marvel.
Does it ever make you nervous if it's a long form piece and you're releasing a portion of it on a regular serialized basis that you somehow shot yourself in the foot, can't go back and rework or restructure the finish?
Well, I hope not, because that's exactly what we have done. You know, the we've been at it online for 2 years now, and we have a very small audience reading that I can see anyway. But that small audience is enough to make sure that we keep doing it. That's, you know, that makes me come back every Friday and do that one page. But as of, you know, a few months ago, I guess the book is actually complete, and now it's just a matter of uploading the pages and you know, post-dating the strip. But at the same time, we've already gone through the editorial process a couple of times. It's had one editorial pass and then come back to us, and now we're making the changes that we want to have for the final print edition. So we're treating it as a work in progress, but as Scott is saying, it's also a way to make sure that people have some idea that it is coming out, because it will have been close to 3 years for us between the initial idea and actually completing it.
I see a lot of artists who and cartoonists who are probably working on a graphic novel or doing their own comics or whatever, but also giving away stuff on the internet that's not their comics. So having an online presence doesn't always even mean putting the work you're working on online. You can have all sorts of people doing
cats.
Yes. But people,
you know, find time for that too.
Small art projects, prints, anything you can sort of create. People are creating, and there's all sorts of cottage industries and people creating all sorts of crafts and artwork to gain attention without even putting their comics online and using that as sort of a small business to fund the comics that they're creating behind that digital wall.
Yeah. Looking towards the future, it's a bit of a loosey-goosey question. I was looking at because I'm at the newspaper, we're looking at the Kindle DX.
Oh, yes.
Wow. And I forwarded it to my managing editor, and I'm like, hey, check it out. And there was also somebody posted something where they said, you know, if you do the math right, like, people that have subscriptions to the New York Times, you could actually stop producing the paper, mail them a Kindle for free,
yeah,
and it would end up costing the same amount.
Wow. Well, and how much is the DX? It's a lot.
It's about $500.
That's a lot.
But what the model that is happening with this is, for the New York Times and the Washington Post, if you're outside of their daily delivery area, you can get a subsidized one, like you'd get a cheaper iPhone with a contract. So those readers may start becoming subsidized by the publications.
Interesting.
So now they can sell you more publications, like how Apple sold 1 billion applications on the iPhone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stuff like this is exciting, and I compiled this email, sent it to my managing editor, like, to check it out. You know, we could totally just send a Kindle to everyone and stay in business, and I could keep my job. and he wrote back, "What's a Kindle?" Wow, which was awesome. I'm like, yeah, it's a joke.
In his defense, they're not available in Canada.
That's
so
true.
This is true.
I can go get one.
We have to have a global vision now, thanks to you.
Okay, I have heard you rule that, but the point is, if it's not physically available,
There are other companies coming out with similar things. Like, I think Hearst Magazines was putting together a reader to help replace paper distribution of magazines. Like, they'd sell you a reader, and then they'll sell you an inexpensive magazine subscription via the reader.
Yeah.
Actually, Hearst, neat. King Features is owned by Hearst, so I'm a Hearst employee, actually. Mm-hmm. They are. They actually own. They're really smart. They, in the early days of this e-ink thing, they bought the technology.
They own so they have the patent?
They have
a couple of different competing patents, actually.
There's a couple different ones. The ones they have is, I think, called E-Ink or something. Yeah. And this is the one they are using for the magazine.
Yeah. That was floating around when I was seeing the early prototypes of places like IBM. It's like, okay, yeah, we're going to see a few different versions of this coming along.
And there are variations. They don't have any stake in the Kindle, but yeah. You know, their technology was, like, I guess it's somehow with Sony. I don't know the whole story behind it.
At what point do we jump in as artists into this format. Because I know you've been toying around with like reformatting for Kindle. Also, they come up with a large Kindle.
Well, that was the thing. I was going to reformat this spring, start chopping up comics for the Kindle, and then this came out. And what's great is the resolution on the new Kindle DX is bigger than most webcomics I read.
Yeah.
So you actually, it's like, it's manga-sized and it's high enough resolution that you can probably read a comic book page without screwing with it. And it's going to, and they're probably going to largely be deployed in bulk at universities, which is where all the bored kids who started reading webcomics 10 years ago came from.
Yeah.
So it's encouraging that it'll be in hands of people who want to waste time reading comics.
The one thing that I've seen as a consistent is that there's no consistency. And disruptive technology is going to continue to disrupt every 2 years, mm-hmm. basically. And there's no way for us to hang our hat on one thing.
But this,
the thing we should hang our hat on is agility. You either have the ability to, you know, work with a new device, a new platform, or you're dead. And this is what I was talking before about being able to put your thing in a bunch of different places. I don't think interchangeable parts and the Industrial Revolution is going to occur today the way it did 150 years ago.
Maybe. Now there's a plateau of interoperability that I think we're heading for probably in the next 5 or 6.
Well, I hope so, desperately. But
the new Kindle's a step towards that in the sense that it's reading PDFs.
Can you guys speak up?
All right, sorry. But the new Kindle's a step towards that because it's reading PDFs and you can sell PDFs.
Yeah.
So even if you don't like Amazon, there will be other things to do PDF. So you can drop it and move on to the next thing in 2 years.
Eventually, the Kindle is going to just be a full-blown web browser, and everything's going to be free again, and then we're going to be right back at square one.
If
you start heading in the direction of netbooks, I mean, really, what people really want is just access to everything all the time, and that's still a very powerful force that's going to be heading more towards netbooks rather than sort of proprietary controlled distribution networks and things like that. And I don't have a Kindle yet, but I have a grudge against the aspect ratio, which is kind of psychotic. But I have a little blog post up recently with a little happy face with two eyes on top, you know, one on top of the
other. You're a cartoonist, you can be psychotic.
It's just not compositionally
but it's just a thing. You know, for me, there are aesthetic problems with embedding spatial metaphors in hardware. Well, because at least on the web, we can always screw around with that, you know, and you have open standards. But that's another thing entirely. But in fact, I have no idea what I was
We're all part of the matrix. You won't have to worry about it.
Well, I'm interested in the aspect ratio. Just so people... I read it.
I can do it very, very quickly.
People know.
Yeah, I have a bit of a grudge match with the whole notion of people feeling like the shape of print, the natural shape of all comics pages should be that, because that's what we're used to. But in fact, we have two eyes next to each other, and that's why TV and movies and theater and everything else is like wider than it is tall, is because it fits our field of vision. And the shape of print is not an upright rectangle, it's two upright rectangles next to each other. That's how you read, you open the book, it's still that shape. Everything's always that shape. There's a reason for that. And then people get on the web and they make pages this shape and then it doesn't fit on the screen and then you have to go find a scroll button and it's so irritating. It's basically like McLuhan's thing about like we've appropriated the shape of the previous technology as the content of the new technology, and it's like, get over it, the shape, you know, the screen is shaped this way. And Meredith Grant had, you know, she had this nice screen-shaped comic octopus pie in the old Kindle. I know the new one auto-rotates, right? You can do the thing where you can make it landscape, and good for them.
And it works. I tried the resolution.
Yeah, which is awesome. It's just like the iPhone, you can turn it sideways. So it's like good for them, points for them. But,
it's halfway.
Yeah, that's my whole thing. But that's just my sack of potatoes or whatever. I worry if the nature of the network, which to date has allowed people to adjust their mistakes on the fly and say, oh, you know what? I just realized everybody reading my comic is losing the last bottom inch of it, and that's stupid. Why don't I just make the pages a different shape?
Yeah.
The idea that you might not be able to do that because suddenly someone has decided, no, this is what print looks like, and we built it in hardware, and now...
We
made the decision for you. That worries me a little.
It's funny because I read your blog post and I just started reading it's the Eisner-Miller interviews that Brownstein did. And they both stop and they start railing against the format too. Like, why are comics like this? Why does it have to be like that? And, you know, why can't it be wide? And we're going this way and that way. And I'm not sure if Frank Miller's ever been on the internet. Has he been on the internet?
I don't know. Miller doesn't have a web presence, but I remember Miller saying comics pages are too skinny.
Yeah.
And that's actually true. I mean, there should be a little squarer personally. I think we've been too skinny for a while.
Yeah, I love a fat comics.
A little flesh on those.
That's usually not a complaint usually railed against America. They're leveled against America.
No.
It's nice to hear that we're too skinny.
Not usually an American problem.
What's that now, Frank Miller, he incorporated that with 300. It's almost kind of widescreen.
Landscape. Yeah, except that's wrong, too.
Because he has two landscape things next to each other.
Now it's
I don't have four eyes, dude.
Not that wide. It's like wide.
Miller's always been a little bit crazy.
Yeah, no, but it's okay. I like that he's always
Well, the original comic book versions of that were just wide. It's, I think, that large hardcover that he came out, which was double wide. So the comic books
one I have.
Maybe had the right spirit there.
I'm worried about your field of vision, Mike.
Look, Jim, some of us just think it's good to implant a new eye. I'm working on it.
You must love those, like, Pete Maresca books, those Sunday funny books that he did, like, Little Nemo.
I love those. They're beautiful.
Yeah. You step back 3 feet and read them.
Let's open up to some questions from the audience. And if they're not good, I'll just worry. Hi, you with a boom mic.
Two questions I have would be, speaking of formatting, you guys familiar with Infinite Canvas, which is Microsoft tool that reformatting the way that the comics can be put on the web. And they also wanted to know if you guys want to talk about a little bit about CBR and CBZ comic formats, which is another way to distribute comics digitally. iPhone or my cell phone has a CBR reader as well, which is a really neat. I mean, a lot of the comics are illegal scans, but
so it's really neat for the reader.
Let's talk about that topic.
Yeah, I was about to say.
That's a different panel.
I don't have
much
familiarity with that one.
But it's a new way to get your work out there on the corporate places.
Well, we should explain quickly what this. You mentioned Microsoft's Infinite Canvas. I know this guy Ian Gilman at Microsoft, who's part of the Sea Dragon Group, had created it to fulfill some of the stuff I was talking about in my books. And it's pretty raw. I mean, it's very, but he got a couple of things right. If you check it out, it's just Infinite Canvas. Google Infinite Canvas, because that's not the URL, but it's just a nice little cute toy where you can just upload images right away and just start putting them on this sort of broad canvas. But he's using a lot of spatial navigational metaphors. It gets a little murky. It's a little confusing. But there are a few things like that. There's Prezi, which is a presentation tool from Hungary, and they're also talking to me about like using this for comics and all, and that's where you have the zooming panning thing. There are lots of people who are playing with these sort of spatial navigation metaphors, where basically what you're doing is, instead of reducing comics to one panel at a time in a slideshow on a mobile phone, you're going in the opposite direction saying, oh, this is a 300 panel comic, I'm just going to throw them all down at once. And now you just get to zoom out and zoom in and just navigate through them. And this is something that I've been interested in for a long time. But it's still a lot of people sort of on the fringe trying out different ways to implement it technologically. And it's rough. It's raw. It doesn't always work. But ultimately, it's one of the directions I want to see things go on. And it's one of the reasons why being out in the wild and having open standards allows people to try this stuff out. Instead of having a company, even a well-meaning company like Apple, say, oh, and here's how comics are going to work. You know, like for a while with iTunes, it was like, and comics, they'll be like movies too, only movies you can stop. And it's going to be great. And you don't get another choice because why should you? This is great. Thank us now. And it's like,
but it's funny how Apple now gives out MP3s or unlocked files.
Yeah.
Thanks to that. No. The fact that there's open stuff, people want it.
Right.
Well, yeah.
People forget that paper is technology too, and it's,
yes.
You know,
thank you.
It's light and it's relatively weatherproof and it's portable, and yeah, you can take it with you and you can put it aside for a while and it doesn't die on you.
Here.
This paper stuff. and the formats are almost, but not quite, infinite. So you can have a small square comic, or you can have a landscape format comic, or tall, or whatever.
But not too wide.
No.
I won't like it.
So it's so wrong with scroll.
No, no.
Well, you also can't find the scroll button. So.
Well, the scroll is the button.
Yeah,
right.
So I guess, you know, personally, I find the mechanisms for reading on different devices fascinating, but I also find that they tend to get in the way of enjoying the story. Which, you know,
and
to me...
No, there's no standard either.
Right. So, I mean, as far as we're concerned as cartoonists, as creators, you know, if we're sequestering part of our mind in dedicating time to figure out, you know, how is it going to fit on this device and how is it going to fit on this device and do I have to prepare it to reformat it for something else, then we're not thinking about the important thing, which is... telling a good story that people are going to enjoy.
If I don't want to derail this or anything, but just very quickly, this is one of the most important points out there. And then, okay, I'm ready. And it's transparency. And this is a lot of when all this was starting, and I was talking about things like the infinite canvas and all. The idea was let's try a zillion different things. I had some ideas. I thought others would have ideas. In the end, it just became more about okay, McLeod, what do you have? And it's just like it wasn't really what I was looking for.
Yeah.
I just wanted people to try a whole lot of different shit and find out what worked.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the time to concentrate on form, concentrate on format, and make sure that we had thrown spaghetti against every wall we had, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, but I'm mixing metaphors, sorry. Okay.
That works.
The goal, though, always, as far as storytellers was, that we would settle on certain formats that we found were most transparent and allow people to lose themselves in the story, in the artwork, just as they do in print. Mm-hmm. I compare it to when you're reading a print comic and your right hand is sort of maneuvering up to get ready to turn the page without you even knowing it. Mm-hmm. So that when it comes to time to turn the page, you don't even take your eyes off the art. Shouldn't ever take your eyes off the art. It's my major complaint with the whole, scroll here to get the rest of the page and then look for the next button and then go, the whole page should be a next button. The page should fit the screen. And you should just be click, read, click, read, click, read, click, read. But scroll, read, scroll, read, scroll, read, scroll, read was also transparent in the sense that it was consistent.
Mm-hmm.
All I was looking for was consistency. So even the crazy infinite canvas stuff is still consistent in the sense that all I'm doing is just moving through this thing. Mm-hmm. And if the mode of navigation never changes, then you can lose yourself in the story just as you did before. That's always been the brass ring.
But so you've got proprietary formats or
exactly,
devices.
Right. So now we have boring formats, mm-hmm. but as artists, we pay attention to the form. But the final goal, the final resting place for this stuff, hopefully will be a few different formats, but all of them delivering that one thing, which is that when people start reading, they forget the format until they're done, especially for long form stuff, for comic books and graphic novels.
You know, you can play this up in the opposite direction too. You can have the kind of story where you're like, I want you to work for the next page, so you have to click this button, pull over this scroll bar, move on, backslash it, more comic, please.
Have you seen that? There's an iPhone app called Instapaper, mm-hmm. which is just, it's an e-reader. There's no, I don't know if you can do graphics on it yet, but it has one feature I haven't seen anywhere where, because of the motion of the iPhone, you scroll just by tilting.
You see, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking for. The only interaction is moving your hand. You don't have to press anything, and it's really cool.
But Apple is trying to control these gestural movements as far as other companies. Yeah, they are.
No, this is
so you don't do this.
You're like behind you, moving you.
Not bad. Other companies are trying to implement this kind of technology in their smartphones, mm-hmm. and Apple is making moves against that kind of thing because they want to control how people spread their fingers or tilt the device or whatever.
There are multiple multi-touches out there. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there were a few different prototypes. Apple snagged one, others snagged others.
Mm-hmm.
And the multi-touch is the most natural way. If you want to scroll, you shouldn't be hunting for anything. You should be reaching down your hand and just doing this.
Like
it should always have been like that.
I just picture Apple controlling that gesture.
that's alarming because for them to decide that you must do it this way, it's not going to work a lot of the time for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And for them to get into the psychology and physical nature of everyone's behaviors is
this is to announce that Yoshihiro Tatsumi is now signing at the Drawn and Quarterly booth on the main floor, 2:00 until 4:00. 4. He's the author of A Drifting Life, Mr. Yoshihiro Tatsumi.
I think I'm signing too. Am I signing it too? Oh, 2:30. Oh,
2:45.
I couldn't tell.
I'm signing at 2:45. That brings into my question.
The announcement did, or?
Take a look at what's outside there. There's your niche audience. Everyone's got books. If everything goes on to the internet, what happens to your beautiful produced private published editions?
I don't think anything will happen.
No, they become. How do cartoonists actually make a living?
The thing is, anything that is digital can be copied and will be copied, and no one's going to be able to stop that. So how people are going to make their money is not in vast ways that I think they did with mass publishing that they do today, but with creating a small niche audience, but the way Rich does and with the way he does merchandise and creating a sort of a smaller economy for a smaller group of fans, but making hopefully an equivalent amount of money, I think.
Also less overhead, but you're not supporting a whole publishing house or an industry on your own.
And the books become more special in a way, too. You know, like, I'm happy to squirt out comics every day, you know, like crazy. I know. But if once or twice a year I sit down and go through an editorial process and make a really solid, desirable book, that's the end result. And all year long, people have been enjoying things for free. There's no strings attached, and some percentage are going to just want to buy the damn thing. You know.
Also, one of the beauties of having this intangible version of comics is that it makes the tangible stuff
more valuable.
Well, you also notice it aesthetically for the first time, because when I was starting out, everything was on print, so nobody really noticed print, and very few people really thought about print and its tactile qualities and creating a beautiful object. And now they often do. A lot of the stuff that's out there is carefully created. They're thinking about texture and color and creating something beautiful to hold. And that's because there's an alternative. Before there was an alternative, when I started in 84, everything was on paper. The paper sucked.
And all comics.
It all looks the same. Yeah, they all look the same. They all look the same. Because this is just how you get your message across, is through paper. And so paper was invisible because it was ubiquitous. Now it's visible. Now you go out there, you see paper. You see paper and feel paper in a way you never did before because you know there's an alternative.
And it's causing people to do more of a handcrafted thing. Yeah. The contrast is huge. You know, I mean, it's great to read panel on the internet. But now you're deciding to what you're going to put on paper, and you're thinking about every step. You know,
and this goes back to you mentioned the CBZ format, because that can be copied too. So if you can photocopy one of Stewart's comic books, put it in CBZ form, or scan it in, put it in CBZ format, and throw it on BitTorrent, then his physical object book is lost its value too. So it's when you add these little touches and the new kinds of paper and you think about the inking and the process and the object you're holding in your hand, that's where the value comes in.
It depends on the type of comic too. Like they'll tear apart an issue of Spider-Man and scan it, put it online, and everyone will download it because they just need to know what happens to that character.
Yeah.
And they need to see the art. Whereas one of your self-published books, like, you know, I'm not like, I can't wait for the CDZ of like everyone wants that. They physically want that.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, it's definitely craft oriented, and I think texture and material do absolutely play a greater part now than they have before.
Yeah.
Like Scott said, that, you know, as little as 15, 20 years ago, if you made a comic format was fixed, and they all looked like every other comic.
And the paper sucked, too. I mean, it was bad.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like the old man saying this, but, like, if anyone thinks, like, print is dead, like, you just have to walk around and take a look at the products that are out there. They're gorgeous. They're beautiful.
It's an extension of the tangibility of the person whose hand you're shaking. You know, you're going out there and meeting these people. You're shaking the hand of somebody whose work you've enjoyed in a non-tangible way all this time. That's an extension of them. That's an extension of the fact that there's an actual hand.
And there is
an actual book to go with it.
And they can leave the book with you.
Yeah.
Like, it's the handshake that comes home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the handshake that comes home.
Go with that.
The reason people are so alarmed is because the mass market is in trouble. The ability to reach people who aren't comics fans is in trouble. The ability to get to the person... Look, the secret, dirty little secret here is that comics aren't as popular as we think they are. You know, in newspapers, it's true. In newspapers,
they're just there.
They're there. It's part of something they bought to get their sports score and their local news and weather, et cetera, et cetera. And that's been a huge business for 100 years for a lot of people. The reason everybody's running around freaking out like the sky is falling is because that is the part that's going away. Our ability to cultivate a audience that's enthusiastic will never go away. The question is, can it put us all in skyscrapers in New York City? That is in jeopardy.
Slight important correction, though. You said comics are not as popular as we think. You mean newspaper comic strips?
Yes, yes.
In print, yes, yes, are not as popular. And that's a very important distinction, because comic strips as a form, and comics as a form, by appealing to, you know, other genres, other interests, and entirely outside of the newspaper, the classic example being something like Penny Arcade or XKCD,
right,
are wildly popular right now. And it's because they are finding groups that are not necessarily seeking out comics per se, but they're seeking out this subject matter.
Right. But I think it does extend to books as well, because the newsstand is hurting the occasional impulse buy of a comic book. I mean, this has been in jeopardy for a long time, because the idea of a single comic book with a single Spider-Man story is dashed 25 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. So that's been in jeopardy for a long time. But it's true. I think that we need to understand that we have enthusiasts and pockets of enthusiasts, and you're either comics fans or they're fans of, you know, advanced math. And there's a comic that speaks to that.
But the internet allows the creator to find those pockets,
exactly,
in a way that wasn't possible
before. It's a different approach that's required here, absolutely.
To the lovely lady in the
I'm not really sure I agree with you, because I know in my borders, a store that used to maybe carry a spinner rack of comics, there's now, you know, several aisles worth of manga, and there's now like 4 or 5 sections of American comics. Barnes & Noble is carrying comics. These are all stores that would never have carried comics 10 years ago. And I see kids sitting there reading them. I see old people sitting there reading them, you know, around the store. And I think in our neighborhood, in order to go to a comic store, you've got to go an hour in any direction to get to one. So people buy them at Borders, but they can buy them at Borders.
Yeah.
But are these short serialized things like a pamphlet comic or a comic strip, or are they
Yeah,
and I think those are different things as well.
And Scott was right. I should have prefaced that by saying comic strips. I mean, the comic strips are astronomically popular among people who don't really care about them all that much. They're like, I'm not kidding. Literally, hundreds of millions of people read comic strips every day. But if you were to take them away, only about 1 million of those people would complain.
Yeah, it'd be like, you changed my shoelaces.
Right, yeah. Exactly. It's not that remarkable for people, and that's what's alarming, is that has been a huge industry for a very long time.
If 1 million people complain, doesn't that mean that there's 10 million people who are actually upset? Because isn't it only like 1/10
of 25? It's 1 to 25.
Actually say anything. So
I don't disagree. I'm just trying to reduce our understanding of how popular comics are. They're very popular because they're in a lot of places, but how passionately they're being digested in all those places is very misleading.
But even my experience in the big box stores is that they do have a lot of material, and maybe Borders is different than Indigo or Chapters here, but whenever I go into Chapters and look at the graphic novel section, they're all spine out, and they're alphabetized according to title.
Yeah.
So you've got... Yeah, so yeah. If you have... you know, someone who creates one graphic novel with one title, and then spends the next 3 years doing something else with a different title, those books will be, you know, in two different racks.
There's definitely a classification problem. But
so, I'm just saying that the stores have yet to realize how to...
Although often people discover it through people's web presence, and there that organization takes place ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to the store looking. You know that Chris Ware has a new book out, mm-hmm. and the fact that it begins with Y instead of D doesn't really stop you, because you know the name.
But if you're looking for... You can look for the book that you already have, and you recognize that spine, and then you're looking for his other works, and they're nowhere near.
Yeah, that's true.
Then
it's
then
a big problem. I mean, you've got a collected trade paperback of the latest Spider-Man Spider-Man stories sitting next to Acme Novelty Library. That's
yeah,
also
amazing. Spider-Man's is you've got material. You've got material for different audiences. You've got mature material in some cases next to stuff for kids, and the stores need to step up.
And in terms of the visual, as you pointed out, of like, you know, kids sitting there reading and people reading, you know, having worked at the Chapters, I hate those people. Because they just sit there on the floor and they finish their comic because it's not a novel. I mean, you know, they want to go through a collection of Batman or manga, like, they can just they're not really taking it all.
Some of them are doing it out there.
Yeah, that's true.
Right in front of you.
Yeah, right in front of you. Which
you just said, you're saying this ain't a library.
And also, like, at the end of the day, I go past the graphic novel section and I just be like, oh, okay, this is going to have to be returned or going to be discounted or grubby little child hands with their crazy little fingers. They're in the future. Don't get me wrong. I love them. any other questions?
National newspapers have a habit of releasing different editions. Do you see that factor into the future of the newspaper?
I'm sorry?
Like regional editions of national
newspapers? Yeah, only because it's not an extremely common practice. I don't think it's a concern or even necessarily a benefit. I think that, you know, here you have the Globe and Mail, right, and the National Post. In the United States, you have, you know, USA Today, and then those big papers that are, you know, the papers of record, like New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. It's such a few, limited few. And by the way, most of those don't carry comics.
Mm-hmm. Although the Times is, I mean, one thing that we have now is that the papers that previously didn't carry comics are just carrying really good comics.
Right.
You know?
In ironically, the magazine.
Yeah, in the magazine.
Yeah, but what I'm saying, frankly, at the National Post, we put out two editions every day. That's it. We put out the Toronto edition, we put out the National edition. Mm-hmm. And the National's paper thin, no comics there, no siree. Also, I wasn't going to cry at this panel. How can we save my job?
Maybe you could save an airplane from terrorists.
You know,
it's funny. To fame sell t-shirts.
Well, you'd be so famous they couldn't fire you. You were very specific with your question.
I was going to mention this earlier with Brendan with single-padded. With that collection. That's focusing on kind of a journalistic kind of essay comics, and I feel like if you're working in a newspaper, that's what you should be working towards. Like, that makes the most sense. But, you know, it's something that, you know, is an actual story. You're actually working on something.
It's 5-month-old news.
It's funny because I when I started doing those I really like nonfiction. I like essays a lot, and I also really like comics. So I was like, oh, this makes sense. I had like a eureka moment. Talking to all people, Art Spiegelman, he said, you should call my friend Roger Hodge at Harper's Magazine. He will run these stories. Yeah. And I said, that's crazy, but he might be right. You know, that's a great idea. But and, you know, you're starting to see interesting things, you know, like Alison Bechdel and Ward Sutton have done book reviews in comics form.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this is wonderful. This is a great way to penetrate an audience. And by the way, this is that audience that does not read comics that I was talking about before. Penetrate them and come to them where they are on their terms and give them something to look at and hopefully identify with.
Just quickly, because of the situation a lot of newspapers are in, like they're working with less resources, less staff, when you can approach a newspaper and go, hey, I can take care of the text and the visuals. Like, they don't have to hire a photographer, you know, it's going to be a lot easier to edit. It's such an ideal thing. I don't know why more people...
It has a personal touch to it as well. Yeah. I think people, they tend to just, it registers and stays in there, you know, burned into their memories a little bit more than, and I don't know, magical there.
The last 10 years, every article you read about comics says, did you know that comics aren't just about superheroes and talking animals anymore?
Yeah. And it's stories like that, they're going to have to...
And they... None of those stories ever say, except in the newspaper, where it is superheroes and talking animals, and that's how it should be. And so, I agree. That
technically, Garfield.
The more we can do superhero, the more we can do stories like this, then the more the less people will preface their article, "Hey, comics aren't just for kids anymore," which is the most tiresome, you know. And bothersome.
And we try not to do it in the post. Like, there's enough people on staff that are kind of comic savvy that.
Well, that's what's happening, is that our moles have been infiltrated, basically.
Yeah.
You know, when you're talking about the idea that, oh, this piece about this particular subject might make it into Parker's, might make it into these places where people are reading, you're basically talking about the notion of content first. And at content leading with content.
Yeah.
What it's about is more important than the form it takes. You're interested in this, you fish. You want to read something about fishing? Here it is. You know, and this is exactly what Will Eisner was always saying, that content drives the industry and the art form. But it's becoming true to a degree and in a form that he didn't even anticipate, which is the idea that content could just like completely be freed from form. I was like, you mentioned the airplane thing, and I swear to God, like the last half hour, I have this picture in my mind of like the newspaper comics industry is like, you're in an airplane, right? And like the entire plane just blew apart, and now you just have these two rows of people just sitting all still together, and just like,
they're steering.
Hey, when's the stewardess going with the coats? You know, it's like what happened is like the form blew away, but there's still. At the core of it, there's still stuff to say, things to read about, and comics can find 100 different directions to go if we can only find the fucking parachute.
Yeah.
You know, we get there.
This is what I was talking about before, and I want to make sure that this is made clear, because I don't want everybody to walk away thinking, that guy's really gloomy. He thinks that people don't like comics. What I'm saying
is... He's gloomy for other reasons.
That's true. I'm just saying we need to disabuse ourselves from the idea that a huge... industry like comic strip syndication and newspapers is not a good idea for the future. It's probably not something we can do. We need to go out there and change the stories we're telling, how we tell them to the audience we want to try to get to, and not just say, well, because they're funny and they're in this newspaper that everybody's already buying, we're going to be okay. We're not going to be okay if that's the approach.
Well, you want to have an answer before the plane blows up.
Yes, yes, exactly. Forget parachutes. How about like a really good pilot, you know, who might be able to...
Or jetpacks.
Or jetpacks.
Or we can just drive.
God. Trains.
Any other questions? Ooh, here we come.
Question for Canadian artists in the comic industry. We're talking about chapters in the Euro and previous books, so they only had Watchmen and the movie was still going on. But 10-5 years ago, Watchmen that did not exist in India. In terms of DC and Marvel, it's American. In terms of European, there's only Alan Moore and a few others that are making a play. But for the leading market, I don't see comics as the biggest thing in Canada that have shit. So for a Canadian artist, what should he be doing to attract himself in Canada before going and sell this world to the US?
Well, I think we touched on that by when we said that the mass market's disappearing, and you don't have to concern yourself about making it big in Canada, because if you have the internet, you make yourself big in your global community that's interested in what you have to say as a cartoonist or an artist, and so you can build a community that's, you know, completely suited to what you are producing. I think
it's just it's redefining that common denominator phrase. You know, no longer are we saying common denominator, it has to be wholesome, simple for everybody to get, but the common denominator might be it has to be a group of people who are really interested in video game playing. I'm going to do something for them. You know,
you think it's really the reverse strategy. It's exactly the opposite of a common denominator. It's drilling down to that intense molten core of fascination and passion and specificity. That, you know, like, yes, I know, like, what essentially what Gabe and Tycho did with the video game readers is they didn't say, hey, we're doing a strip about video games. What they did with it, they did a strip about video games where they proved that they were every bit as obsessed with video games as their readers. Ditto with the math thing in XKCD.
And again, that definition now takes on the phrase common denominator is, their common denominator is a very specific thing.
It's just not
a very broad.
It's not the lowest.
It's a common denominator.
Common denominator.
The highest common denominator. The idea of a distribution infrastructure is completely disappearing.
But I think that the strip analogy leaves out someone like Will Eisner, who is interested in a number of different subjects, wrote and drew graphic novels based on one idea, and then went on to do something else. So how does that kind of creator take advantage of this?
But that's a very natural fit. The idea that you discover somebody's work through their content, mm-hmm. and you fall in love with their stuff, you realize that you're enjoying it as a story, even though really you just wanted to, read about a carpenter or something, because that's
right.
what you do.
Right.
And then you realize, wow, and this now he has this new thing about how he decided instead to try to become a pro football player.
Right.
I'm going
to
do that.
You don't think that you'd have to run into the same audience building barrier?
I mean, we had no interest in... oh, no, that's the wrong example. I'm sorry. Sports Night came first. I was going to say, we had no interest in sports. We watched Sports Night, but then we didn't know who he was. So that doesn't... Never mind. It's a lousy analogy.
Well, it's more like if you're a really good author and you can do six different books, each with a different cool hook topic that you're interested in...
Yeah.
Every time you do it, you can hit a new slice, and you might build up a small percentage that will follow you from book to book who truly liked you.
Sure.
So every time, it's like you get a reintroduction to a different group every time.
And you still have the core that were interested in you, and you asked
they really
like
you
in the first place.
Sure. Right. So if I read your golf book, I might see Scott McCloud on the top of a book at the airport, and I needed a book to read. I remember his last one.
A while ago on Boing Boing, Cory Doctorow posted a link to this essay manifesto about the idea of 1,000 true fans for an independent creator.
Yeah.
And the idea is that all you have to worry about as an independent creator, instead of trying to find this mass market and trying to break into it, concentrate on your 1,000 true fans, which is 1,000 people in the entire world who are willing to spend $100 on you a year. There's your salary.
Yeah. Or the 1,000 can vary, but
it could be 2,000 willing
term.
To spend 50.
Yeah,
exactly.
As long as people don't get hung up on a number.
Yeah, exactly. Just concentrate on your community.
Maybe 50 people that buy $1,000 worth of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I love this story about Michael Jansey, who does the Norm comic strip, and he was syndicated with King Features, and it wasn't going well. I mean, and I think one of the reasons it wasn't going well is because he spoke to a very specific readership. You know, it was all about guys like him. And there's nothing wrong with this. There's absolutely a lot of guys like him who are going to identify with this strip. And he said, I'm no longer syndicated. I'm pulling out of my website, which was very popular too. And they said, no, please don't. And he goes, all right. If 2,000 of you will pay me $100 a year, I'll keep doing it. And they did.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's wonderful.
That's how it will work. Some of the time. Yeah, a lot of the time.
It's a little bit of a... chicken or the egg thing, though, is how do you cultivate that passion initially? How long do you stick with it and lose money and suffer through it to cultivate that
initial push,
and it's not just initially either. I mean, if that's your business model, you've got to maintain that year after year. And when you have some attrition, or people fall off, or they forget to pay you that year, or you've got to go out of your way to find more to replace it.
Oh, and there's one other thing: you have to be good.
Well, I was just going to say that. I think this system is a complete meritocracy.
Can't be a hack.
It's,
yeah.
The cream will rise to the top. That's good for consumers as well, because it means hopefully better stuff for us.
Delicious cream.
Yeah.
For everyone. Any other questions?
Lap it up, Siddharth.
This one's more direct towards Mr. Eminent and I guess Scott as well. Because we've been talking a lot about comic strips, but in terms of actual comic books.
Mm.
Marvel's already been doing a thing where you can really subscribe to get full comic books online and have the old Apple they have through the pages, stuff like that. How much do you see that expanding in the next 10 to 20 years? Do you see that overtaking comic books at all? Or
I don't see it overtaking, but I think that Marvel is like everybody else, and they're putting their fingers in all the pies that they can think of doing. And I don't think that they're overstaffed by any means, and they have to find the budget to work on these ventures. But when they see their print numbers drop, they'll try different formats in print, the collected editions, for instance, but they'll also be trying other media as well.
Is there any information on whether or not giving away comic books for free increases paperback sales or not? Do you know what I'm getting at?
Like, yeah, I don't know if Marvel or DC or any other publisher has done any kind of marketing.
Comic Book Day brings a lot more people into the comic shop that day every year. But beyond that,
every day should be free comic day.
Well, it is.
It is.
Online.
So many great catchphrases coming up.
We do.
The handshake you bring off is
so bad. That's all we have. That is pretty sad.
There's another panel starting up soon, so we're going to wrap this up. So I'm sorry if there's more questions out there. You can probably harass these guys one on one. With the handshake you can take
home.
Not the bathroom. I'm going to shake your hand in the bathroom and take that home. And everything else associated with it. So that's a great joke to end on. I'd like to thank everyone on the panel for doing this. But thank you all for coming.